are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
Another maddening edition of the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? Still nursing that Madman marathon hangover? We'll talk about the first of the final 7 episodes. Also, the pitfalls of entrenched narratives and the Rolling Stone article that underscores it. Also, another GOP hopeful sets his eyes on the big 2016 prize. Inspiration to Action shout-outs will get you in the line, too, if you're listening live on Tuesday, April 7th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed also up and running at AB Writes. The show today brought to you in part by City Mobile. Bank almost anywhere with City Mobile. Also by PopNet, Arts, Culture, Conversation, on air, online, 24-7. It's the new improved PopNet. Let's start where we love to start, which is the power of storytelling and the creative process. Our guest today can speak about that and then some. She's a multi-talented artist. Lorraine Devon Wilkie is a singer-songwriter, photographer, and novelist. Her latest book, her second book, Hysterical Love, is officially launched today. What an honor to have her here to talk about all that. But let's start with her music, because I just kind of stumbled upon her music and what a sound she has. She kind of resides next to people like Melissa Etheridge, Lucinda Williams, Lone Wainwright. It's rich, it's resonant. I think you'll enjoy it. Here's one called My Search for You, Lorraine Devon Wilkie, opening up a very busy Tuesday edition of the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show.
You were puzzled by my need for clarity. Maybe you thought I depended on language too much, but there were volumes you didn't say or I never heard. I know you thought the way you loved was surely enough. I wonder if you ever figured out how your silence always made me feel a little loud. So convinced if I sang and danced and jumped up and down, you would see me, just me, and maybe be a little proud. And sometimes I know that you heard me. Sometimes I know that you cry, but you left me in early December. You loved me, but we both knew our time was through. Now I stand here and try to remember the girl I discovered. They love doesn't ask for more than what it gets. So why did I always want a bigger piece of you? In the crush of life, I was sometimes lost in the crowd. Never sure if I ever came completely into view. But somehow I learned to be stronger. Somehow I'm certain you knew, but you left me in early December. You loved me, but we both knew our time was through. Now I stand here and try to remember
great sound. Lorraine Devon Wilkie and My Search for You from her collection Somewhere on the Way on the Amy Beth Arkoui Show. We could spend the whole hour just talking about her music, but she's a multi-talented artist, and her new book is out today. It's called Hysterical Love. Really a pleasure to welcome Lorraine to the show. Hey, Lorraine, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
So happy to have you here, and congratulations on everything, and especially the new book, Hysterical Love, just released today. What an honor it is to talk to you on the official launch day, so congrats.
I know. It's a good timing.
It's very good timing indeed. Let's talk a little bit because, you know, this show, the fulcrum of which is storytelling and creativity, and we have so many listeners who are artists or aspiring artists. What came first for you? Because you have so many different talents, and you've obviously honed the singing and songwriting, I think, first, and then came into fiction later on. How did it start for you? What was the impetus?
Definitely music. When I was a kid, I was involved with a church group, actually. I was raised Catholic, and I was involved with a church group that played the folk masses back in the 70s. And I started singing with that, and then as I got into high school, I did more of that. I did the school musicals, and I was just very drawn to music, I think, for any number of reasons, and just continued that throughout my college life. I hate to admit it, I left college in my third year to go out on the road with a rock and roll band and ended up, you know, just heading west and ended up in Los Angeles, where I continued that road for quite a few years with actually the decade of the 80s, kind of very, very focused almost exclusively on music at that time.
Wow. Yeah, you have this rich voice. I mean, did you always have that rich voice? You have this really...
Thank you.
It kind of reminds me of Melissa Etheridge or Sloan Wainwright, if you're familiar with her sound.
Rock and roll ragged it up real good for a while. You know, I started singing... My Joni Mitchell was one of my mentors, and I kind of bemoaned the fact that I didn't have her sweet soprano, but I learned to appreciate my huskier tones as I got into rock and roll. But yeah, I guess I think I've always appreciated sort of the bluesy, rocky, edgier music, so it's not surprising that that's where my voice kind of went,
That's where it is, yeah. Well, you know, and that's always like a chicken or egg situation. Like, does the voice accommodate what you're feeling inside, or does it all come out together, I guess, is
Well, it's interesting because when I was in college, I was doing musical theater, and, you know, there's always an emphasis on kind of the more classical stage music, a voice, which I wasn't able to conjure up. So I ended up doing the odder shows, the shows that had a kind of a rockier kind of edge to it or a more independent edge to it. So I would, it's probably a mix of both, you know, life imitating art, art imitating life, because voice kind of led me in that direction.
Yeah. And
in other
we all
words,
have different talents.
I wouldn't be asked to do any Disney musicals.
Right. Well, I don't know. You could play, like, some of the character roles, maybe.
There you go.
Ursula in Little Mermaid, maybe, or something. You know?
My God, I used to do that for my stepdaughter. So, yes, you're right. Perfect choice. Perfect choice.
But you know, we all have our talents and our gifts, and then we cultivate them as we go, and our voice and what speaks to us along the way. And certainly you have traversed an interesting path. And where did fiction come into it? I know you did screenwriting for a while too. Is that how you sort of got into fiction after that?
I would say that was true.
That.
I mean, when I was doing music, I was always surrounded by a lot of people who were in the mostly independent film world, you know, writers and filmmakers who were looking to get their films made. And this was during the 80s and late 80s, early 90s, where the push for independent films was very big at that time. And it was a newer thing at that time. And I got involved with a group of people that were, you know, very creative, and I started kind of collaborating with writers and writing screenplays, and I found I really enjoyed it. And so for a period of time, I did have one of my screenplays that I co-wrote with a filmmaker named Patricia Royce, a film called To Cross the Rubicon, that was produced in the early 90s up in Seattle, which was an amazing experience and which, you know, kind of got me hooked even further into that whole medium. But I always wanted to write a novel. I always looked at that as sort of the great vaunted goal of any writer, and kind of considered it something that was kind of off in the misty distance for most of my adult life until more recent years. So yeah, that was the road that got me there, screenplays for sure.
Now, what, and you said that goal of writing the novel was sort of out in the misty distance. I like that. When did the misty distance come closer to you, and what made you take the plunge and say, hey, now's the time, I really want to try writing one? And you did. You wrote your first book, Sucker Punch, right?
for the sucker punch. And I think that, you know, in that case, it really was the story impelled the action in the sense that I wasn't saying, gee, I want to write a novel. What should I write about? I always felt like when I'd get a story, it always felt like it belonged in a screenplay format until I came upon the story that incited After the Sucker Punch, which had a deeper, needed a deeper exploration. And that was the first time that I went, oh, this could be a novel. This is a story that should be a novel, and decided to take the leap, which was really overwhelming at the beginning. I kind of had no idea what I was doing. But I'm a big believer in research and education, and so I kind of immersed myself in the process of learning how to do it, and then just kind of did it. Kind of decided, let me take this story and go with it. And that was really my first foray into the medium, which wasn't that long ago. You know, I think I started that in 2009 or something like that. Yeah, 2009. So it's a fairly new medium for me.
Yeah, and you've got two books now under that belt. It's interesting the way you talk about you let the story come to you and then find its form, because I do that too. I'm also a playwright and a novelist, and I will the story comes in whatever form it comes, and then it attracts whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it lands where it lands, so to speak, you know. So I think that's great. So there's sort of an organic sense, and I always try to import that to people that I speak with, that you have to let the story come to you and then work with it. And then, of course, there's a lot of work to it. It's, you know, when you say that, a lot of people think, oh, it's just, you know, airy-fairy, and aren't you lucky that you have all this, you know, the muse working for you kind of thing. But you have to cajole the muse, and you have to work it every day in order for it to cooperate with you and leave you little gifts and rewards. But
I think that muse. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a heavy lift, yeah. But I do think the best stories are organic. They just come, and at least initially, and then you have to work it. But I think that some people are impatient, and they try to force it. And sometimes, and I've done this too, when you try to force something, it's not happening. So sometimes you have to put it aside. And
well, and I think sometimes you try, like, for example, I wrote a short story, and it's called She Tumbled Down. And I thought about, someone had said to me, oh, you should turn this into a full-length novel. And I sat down and I tried to do that, and I went, no, this is a short story. This is what this is supposed to be, a short story. And so there is that thing that, like you said, where the idea compels you to meet the form. You know, it's like you can't wear a peg in a round hole kind of thing, you know. And not every story is meant to be a novel or a screenplay. You know, I mean, everyone kind of has its own shape and
Well, very often you have stories or novels that then become films, you know, and very often actually short stories in many cases become better films. I know, like Brokeback Mountain was a short story and it was a wonderful movie, and they re-released it. I remember standing in Borders one day and they re-released just the short story because it was so popular, and
only
a short story? And I was like, yeah, but short stories actually make better novels, because a novel, when you have to pare it down on screen. So if it's a really good, rich novel, you're not going to get you might get a decent adaptation, but you're not going to get the whole thing as you would get in a novel.
Well, I agree, and I was going to say exactly that, which is that short story. I mean, I think people don't understand, because they go watch a movie and it's 2 hours long and it seems very long and filled with stuff. But when you know as a screenwriter that a screenplay is generally only about 120 pages, 120 to 150 pages, with lots of white space in between. There aren't a lot of words in it compared to a novel.
Yeah.
And to try to cram a, you know, 400-page novel into that format does mean exactly what you said, which is that a lot of stuff is going to get left out. So a short story does, just by its sheer size, lend itself more gracefully to the movie format, I believe. So I agree with you on that. Yeah. Good point.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, so adaptations are always happening. So do you think about that? Because since you are also a screenwriter, that you know maybe your short story would be a better movie than, say, one of your novels? Or do you have kind of aspirations to translate Hysterical Love or After the Sucker Punch or both to screen?
No, it's interesting. I think I am pretty visual when I write, like in my mind as I'm writing. I don't know if you have this experience, but I kind of see the next scene. Like that used to happen when I was screenwriting, where you'd write a scene and you'd kind of open your mind and go, what would be next? What would I want to see next? And that leads you to your next scene. And the same thing would happen with writing the novel or the short story, that you feel where the characters and the plot want to go. So I think, for me, I always kind of write visually anyway. And so, I do think about movie adaptations. I do think that most of what I've written so far could be successfully adapted to films. And to be completely honest, Hysterical Love is actually the adaptation, interestingly enough, of a screenplay I wrote. So I kind of this backwards. It was a screenplay I wrote that I loved, and it did very well in terms of getting lots of attention in the development phase, but it was never made, and it's just been languishing on a shelf for years. And I went, I love this story so much, and I hate to see it just disappear into the ethers. So let me see if I can adapt it into a novel, which I found daunting at first because it was exactly the opposite of what I just was talking about with, you know, adapting books to film. It's like trying to change the form, and it took me a while to figure it out. But I finally did, and then when I did, it was great fun because I got to take this, the framework of the screenplay, which was nowhere near the depth and breadth of the novel, and completely run with it, which was really, really fun and really satisfying as a writer to take what is essentially a blueprint, which is what a screenplay really is, and completely fill in all the blanks. And so that was really fun.
Because a screenplay, I mean, it's true that writing the screenplay or playwright, which I am, that's a much more collaborative enterprise because you get the actors, directors, all those people involved, especially in the screenplay. The director really takes over and fills in all the blanks. With a novel, you're the one in control. You're in the driver's seat until you get to the publishing phase where you get editors and so forth involved. It's really your calls all the way through. It's not as collaborative. Now, there's pros and cons to that because I think there's something energizing and exhilarating about the collaborative process. I know as a playwright, having directors and actors take your work and bring it to life and inform it in so many interesting ways that you didn't even imagine is so great. But on the other hand, really being the one who's in control and, you know, shepherding the whole project from beginning to end is also exciting. So talk a little bit about making that transition, and which one do you like better, or do you like both equally?
I think, to be honest, I love the process of kind of climbing into my own head and climbing into my bubble that I create when I write and allowing the story and the characters. I'm sure you know what I mean about they tell you what they want to happen. You know what I mean? Don't you feel like follow your characters and the story you've created rather than the other way around? I think that's
definitely.
And for me, that process is really pleasurable. I kind of get lost in it, and I'm always a little bit sad when it's over, kind of like when you're done reading a good book. Well, when you're done writing one and you've really done your last pass through, it's like, oh, I hate to leave this world, you know. I have to say, you know, as a person who did a lot of theater and worked in independent films, I love that collaborative process. I love it when you take it beyond the writing. What I find with writing is for me, writing is very personal. When I was songwriting, for example, I was, you know, I worked with people that would say, well, you know, in places like Nashville, the writers all sit in a room and they all throw lines in and that's how you do it. That wasn't my process. I was the kind of writer where I'd go inside my little pod and I'd come up with the story of a song. And it was hard for me to do that with someone else because it was my story and it was my journey as a writer. I would work with musicians who would then create the music, or they'd create the music first and give it to me and I'd write the lyrics. But the lyrics, the story, was something that I really wanted and was compelled to do on my own. So collaboration is an interesting mix. You know, I for me, in putting words together, I find it's more pleasurable for me to do that on my own, but be outside of that. Collaboration is a joyful experience, you know, just, and I miss it sometimes because, as you know, writing is very isolating. You know, you're in your room and your computer, and, you know, generally there's no one around, and, you know, that can go on for days, weeks, months, years, and I do miss that kind of energy and excitement and exchange of working with other people. So it'd be great fun for me if one of my books got turned into a movie. I'd be thrilled.
It's also, you pointed out the idea of you created some scripts that are just sitting on a shelf. A lot of people don't realize, especially in the screenwriting world, a lot of people go through that. You can write a bunch of stuff, and it might be optioned, and it's sitting around, and nobody ever makes it. And unfortunately, it's like they call it development hell. You're just sort of sitting there, and it gets swirled around, and it never comes out. So I think that can be very frustrating. So it's great when you can see your own work and, for, you know, take control of it. And certainly with a novel, you can do that more easily than a screenplay, unless you're going to make it yourself, which, of course, then you have to get
the funding. Exactly. Well, in fact, I have a friend. Yeah, I mean, I have a friend who's literally his whole career has been spent writing scripts that he was paid well for, none of which have been made.
Yeah,
you know,
tough,
and he said to me, there's pain in that. You know, it's great to have made a living, but there's their work never being seen, and I understand that. And I think that's really, I just actually wrote an article about this. I think that's really the boon of independent publishing, which is that even for novelists, you know, prior to independent publishing really becoming a thing, very few artists, very few novelists were able to get their work seen. And that's just as frustrating. You know, there are as many frustrated novelists with manuscripts on the shelf as there are screenwriters, you know what I mean, prior to independent publishing. Although, of course, the flip side of that is, as we all know, and as is much discussed in the media, you know, they open the gates and, you know, some of the stuff that's flooded out probably shouldn't, but, you know.
That's for sure.
The marketplace,
well, yeah, but it's
interesting
because I do remember the days when I was a kid, when I was first starting out, and, you know, we would send out, and I was in a writing program, and they would say, we'll send out, you know, your stories, et cetera. And the goal was to get a personal rejection from a magazine, you know, The New Yorker or The Atlantic or something. And the first couple of times that happened, I was thrilled. But then it's like, okay, now I want you to say, I don't love it that much, but we're publishing it. You know, so I still remember those days. I mean, I'm old enough to remember those days. Now I teach, you know, creative writing workshops and process workshops, and a lot of people are procrastinators or have sort of defeatist attitude. But a lot of that is lifted because you're right. You can really put your own work out there. So I say you got to get over that. There are other hurdles involved. There are other personal hurdles, which we can talk about, and we have talked about in the show. But in terms of the accessibility of getting your work into the world, yeah, just start a blog and you're out there.
Jack.
Now, that doesn't mean a million people are going to watch, are going to read it, or you're going to get a lot of money for it, but you can put your work out there, and there's something empowering about that. So I do think there's a great thing about the creative age and letting people have that freedom to have a platform, create a platform for themselves. But yes, of course, the flip side is you have to, if you're a reader and you're someone who wants to look for new work and so forth, you have to go through a lot of, you know, sometimes sift through some bad stuff. It's like the bargain rack at the store.
Exactly.
You know, you might get a good, you might find a nice shirt, but you got to go through a lot of, you know, really crazy wine
yeah,
shirts
right.
before you get there.
It's Ross for less in the media world. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, so yeah, that's it. But I really do embrace the creative age that we live in, that everybody can have a form. And the same thing with music, right? Independent music, it's much easier to get your work out there. And I think that's great. I mean, you have a great sound. What is your, you know, your road now to parlaying that, or has that been backburnered in favor of the fiction, or how do you balance both?
Well, you know, I think it's really, I have discovered, like you have, you know, I've discovered that you kind of, I go where the resistance is least. That sounds so passive, mm-hmm. and it really isn't, because I'm very much a forward-moving person. I'm a rabble-rouser, kicking doors and knocking walls. But what I've discovered as I've gone along in my career, and I've done lots of different things, is that you can't keep banging on the same spot on the wall, and if it isn't giving, mm-hmm. you move to a different spot on the wall. You know, you kind of adapt. And in my music career, you know, it's very much, I hate to sound like a cliche, but it is very much a youth market. And when I was working in the 80s, you know, I had my own band, I was plugged in every which way, and I was very young, and it was very exciting, and there was lots of viability to what I was doing. But as you get older, and the marketplace is always looking for the youngest, newest thing, it becomes harder to find ways to keep projects going, because you need money to do that, you need support, and, you know, that became harder to find as I got older. And so that was when I moved kind of into the more independent world, and when digital technology came about, I was able to get my own record made, which was lovely, and I'm very proud of that. But
yeah, you should be.
I have to be very frank and say I haven't cracked the code on any way to position it or parlay that into any major success at this stage of my life. You know, I think that as an older female vocalist, singer, songwriter, whatever, there's not a huge market unless you're already famous. You know, if you're Bonnie Raitt or you're, you know,
yeah,
Lucinda Williams or whatever, then sure, there people are interested in what you're doing. But if you're an unknown, that's not so easy to do. And, you know, I had some people say to me, oh, you should go on The Voice. And I was like, that's just not my thing. You know, I'm not a person who wants to put myself out there in a competitive way of pitting myself against the 20-year-old belter from New York City or something. That's just not my thing. You know, I think people are who they are as artists, their individuality and their uniqueness. And while I applaud what shows like, you know, The Voice and American Idol have offered young singers trying to break in, it's not something that I'm interested to do. So, you know, to answer your question, it is back burner, to be really frank with you. You know, I send out songs for if there's somebody looking for something for a particular show or film but it's definitely been back burnered, mostly out of necessity. There was some possibility that some musicians that I'd worked with in the past, we were going to put a band together earlier this year, but that seems to have sort of drifted off to the wayside because everyone's busy, you know, everyone's busy, got their lives and their jobs and their families. Yeah. You know, it's not being 20 and, you know, being willing to go out in a VW bus and hit the bars in Barstow, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different world when you get older.
That's not as glamorous as you get older, I guess, I would say. But your sound is so rich and it's so interesting because as you get older, for some people, the voice gets deeper and better, and what you have to say is richer and better too. So, yeah, I mean, maybe the way to go is to try to get, besides, you know, airplay, whatever that means these days, on independent, you know, stations and that kind of thing, but also maybe having some of your music attached to TV or film, because that's a good way to make some money too, because that's definitely
great. Well, it's interesting because the song that you played, "My Search for You," the reason that I sent you that one is because that is actually included in my first novel. I actually include it is the epilogue of the book because it fits into the story of the protagonist, who was a singer-songwriter in her past. I gave her a little bit of my own story. And at the end of the book, she has this epiphany and writes the first song that she's written in 5 years. And I thought it would be fun to include it as sort of a pulled right off the page novelty. And so there's a link in the epilogue where you can download that song for free from SoundCloud. And I thought that was a really fun way of pulling in another medium. The book, yeah.
Clever promotional, cross-promotional tool. Yeah, that's very clever. I mean, but you do have a really good sound, so I would encourage you to pursue it in some way, however that shapes up for you. It might not be performing live anymore if that doesn't appeal to you, or you don't have the wherewithal to get it going and the time frame, because we do have a juggling act. And I always say, you know, a lot of people can pursue different things in their lives. You don't always have to, you know, it's very rare to be able to pursue them all at the same time, though. So
yeah, exactly.
If you're pulled in so many different directions, yeah, go ahead.
Well, because you've got to honor each of them with the time and energy that they take to really do well. You don't want to be a dilettante. And, you know, when you're writing a novel and promoting and self-promoting and marketing, you know, that takes an absolutely astonishing amount of time, I've discovered. And you do have to prioritize, you know, and there's only so much time you've got in a day when you've also got a life and a family and, you know, all these other things. So, I mean, I think for me, I love performing live. If somebody called me up, you know, right after this interview and said, "Let's go do a band," I'd be like 21 again, you know, and I'd be all over it, teasing my hair.
Well,
and
you
like,
never know.
You're never right. I love rock and roll. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you never know when it might, you know,
exactly.
your opportunities might come to you. And I think that's also so great, is to let, you know, just like the stories come to you organically, let opportunities come to you. I think sometimes people force it too much. Sometimes, I mean, I don't want to say you shouldn't want it too much, because, you know, ambition is a great thing and you do have to go after things. Like you said, knock down doors, that's really important to be able to do that. But sometimes you have to just sort of let it happen and let the opportunity come to you and kind of stick quietly with your dreams and see how they manifest. They may manifest in a different way than you expected, and that's okay too. In fact, that might be better.
Well, and I think that's something that a philosophy that I came to, and you know, and it was hard won, because when I was younger, I think I did push it too much. I think I valued it too much. It was too much identified with who I was as a person, and so it had to happen because it was who I was. And
mm-hmm.
and then as
yeah.
you get older, you know, hopefully you get wiser. I certainly got wiser, and I really took the time to kind of rethink things. And I think what you said is exactly what I believe. I mean, I think you do everything you can do that presents itself to you, but then you take a breath and you let life kind of unfold, and you aren't browbeating it every 3 seconds to, you know, push it in the direction you want it to go. Sometimes it takes you in very surprising directions. That's certainly been true for my life. And I honor and respect that, because I've learned now that sometimes that route that seems like a detour is actually the absolute best direction to go. And so I do honor and respect that. So you make a good point.
And it plays out into the writing, like we were talking about earlier, too. That's, you let the characters take you on those detours. You know, people always say, "Do you have a?" I never really have a strict outline. I mean, I write mysteries, so I have to have a little bit of an idea of where things are going to go, because I have to plant clues. But I let the characters kind of take me where they're going to go, and then I go back and say, "Well, does this agree? These clues agree with what the outcome is?" Because you have to let the detours happen, and that's true in fiction. I think that's true in your life too.
Yeah, well, sometimes, you know, I've gone back. Like, I don't do a hard outline, but I might do a scene. I used to do, like, a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 scene kind of thing, scene breakdown.
Yeah.
And usually I would start ignoring it, well, you know, shortly into the process of writing it. And sometimes you go back and you go, oh, wow, that was where I thought I was going to go. And that is
exactly.
So not where I went. And yet where I went is so much better. So, yeah,
exactly.
I think that is true in life, too. I really do. That's a good point.
And you can't figure that out, I don't think, when you're 20. You got to work on that as it goes, as your journey progresses. Fascinating. The other thing I just want to mention for folks, because I know there's this whole backlash about how social media is mean, and I just want to say that, you know, we became kind of social media buddies over the last few weeks, and you offer so many interesting things and fascinating links and ideas. You know, it's where you plug yourself into. Don't plug yourself into the haters and the toxic stuff. Plug yourself into the positive stuff, and it's not all boring or just cheerful stuff. It's just positive and, you know, introduces different ideas to people, and I think that's really important. So be careful who you connect with, and you can open yourself up to all kinds of great things, and I'm so happy that we connected, and I wish you the best of luck. Hysterical Love, the new book, is out today. We didn't really talk too much about the specifics of the book, but it does have a lot to do with, I mean, give us a little bit, because we kind of talked about music for more than the lion's share of the conversation, but tell me a little bit about the book so people will go out and buy it today.
Well, I think it's a really fun book. I mean, it's fun and it's heavy, it's deep, and it's also very funny. It's the story of a 33-year-old portrait photographer, a guy whose impending marriage implodes for a variety of reasons, and his father takes critically ill. And in the midst of all this existential chaos, he reads a short story that his father wrote about a long-lost love and discovers that the man still holds a flame for this woman. And when his father gets very sick, and he hears him calling out this woman's name, he becomes compelled, the protagonist becomes compelled to go find this woman, convinced that she's got the answers to all of the romantic questions of the universe. And so the book is kind of his journey through his own life, through his own confusions about relationships and love, and an actual journey where he goes off to Oakland, California to find this woman who he's convinced will help him sort things out. And it's really, the book is that journey, and it covers a lot of really thought-provoking topics, but it's also funny, and it's also a detective story, and it's also got a lot of romantic elements in it. And I think it's a really good read, but it will prick some thought too about how we connect to each other and the ways that we view ourselves and our lives. And so I hope readers will go find it, because I think it's a real satisfying read, and I'm getting a lot of really great responses on it. And it'll make you want to eat pie and ice cream, too, because that's
which is never a bad thing. That's a bonus. But so folks can find out more about it. As we said, it's officially out today, paperback and ebook too, correct?
That's correct, yeah. And it's at Amazon and stores, yeah.
Amazon. Hysterical Love, Lorraine Devon Wilkie is the author. You can also find out more at your website, LorraineDevonWilkie.com. A bunch of stuff about your books, your music, your blog, all of that on the website. Lorraine, really a pleasure talking with you. We could go on for hours. I hope you come back and see us again. I'm going to leave with one more song. Give us a setup. This one's called It's Not Over. This is related to this book, yes?
I picked this one because it sort of fits the book. It's basically a rocker that shouts out, "It's not over till I say it's over." So enjoy it. And thanks, Amy. I really, really appreciate being on the show.
Real pleasure, Lorraine. Thanks so much. We'll talk again soon, I hope. Lorraine Devon Wilkie, find out more at LorraineDevonWilkie.com. Here's another great song, It's Not Over. Give a listen.
Everything I am.
over for Lorraine Devon Wilkie and her music. On the Amy Beth Arkley Show, find out more about her album, Somewhere on the Way, and her books. The latest, Hysterical Love, is out today. Find out more at her website, LorraineDevonWilkie.com. It is the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes. Phone line 2-347-857-4505. Nixie, one of our Heartier regulars chiming in on Twitter, said another great interview, really digging the music, too. We'll check out the book. Well, there you go. See, Lorraine, we're getting you some foot traffic over at the website, I hope. And Pearlie chimes in also, another great conversation, like your commentary and chemistry. Music is good, too. Well, all right, Pearlie, thank you. Reach out and find out more about Lorraine Devon Wilkie. Well, we could have talked to her for hours. She's got so much to say about so many things. I love it when a guest works that way. All that inspiration and storytelling and the power of the creative process, get in there and enjoy it. Speaking of which, our Inspiration to Action Challenge shout-out today, we'll do it early because we're in an inspiring mood, goes out to Connie, who says she's working on a memoir, another memoir. Boy, people love memoirs all of a sudden. Remember that was the it format, the it genre for a while, and then it kind of fell out of favor. Now it's back. Connie is out in Ohio, she says, and working on a memoir. It got me to dig deep into the process and my life. Thank you so much. Well, thank you, Connie. I'm glad it's working for you. Hey, if the Inspiration to Action Challenge is working for you, reach out. We'll give you a shout-out over at the website, amybetharkawee.com. You can also reach out there if you're having some trouble and you need a little creative cajoling. We'll start a creativity coaching counseling conversation. First one always on me. Just give me a week or so to get in touch, and we'll see what we can do about jolting you into a creative mood. That's easy as pie at amybetharkawee.com. All right, so let's get going. Something a little more serious. The Rolling Stone story. Have you been following this? I mean, we talked about it when it first broke, that infamous rape on campus, the story about the young woman who was allegedly raped by, gang raped by some fraternity brothers at UVA some months back. It turned out it was something of a hoax. I'm not sure if it's a complete hoax or just something of a fabrication. We're still not sure about that. But one thing is sure, the way it was told, it didn't happen that way. And the article came under a lot of scrutiny. An independent investigation by the Columbia School of Journalism was underway, and they issued the report late Sunday night and pretty much said what we all knew, that it was shoddy journalism, to say the least. There was no vetting of sources. There was no fact-checking. And I will say, as someone who has been a journalist and has worked for myriad publications, from small local weekly newspapers to regional and national magazines, that there's always some sort of fact-checking or vetting process that goes on. Now, I can't vouch for every single person to the letter that everybody called every source that I gave them, but you're required in most cases, especially with magazine articles, to give a list of sources and a telephone number so that a fact-checker, an editor, somebody can ostensibly call them to confirm that they actually said what they said to you and the quotes are accurate, at the very least. It didn't appear that this woman, Sabrina Rudin-Urdely, I believe her name is, who wrote this article, did any of that. And what's shocking to me is that, according to the publisher of Rolling Stone, she's not losing her gig. I don't know if she's a regular staffer or just a freelance writer that they use fairly frequently, but they said they'll use her again. And no other person, editor, fact-checker, whoever, was fired. I don't really understand that. I mean, I'm not big on, you know, wielding the axe and everybody has to be fired, but there should be some ramifications. Their idea is the ramifications... consequences are enough to be humiliated in public, and she issued a statement saying that she was sorry. It's been a hellish 3 months for her to go through. Too bad, Sabrina, you brought it on yourself. She also went on to say that she believed this woman, Jackie, of course not her real name, and that's okay. I mean, you can use the wrong name, you know, give somebody an alias in an article, but not to vet the story doesn't make sense. Now, as I recall, there were some discrepancies with the story that she knew about, and this is where it becomes really outrageous to me. She had interviewed a bunch of women at UVA, and apparently there's a pattern of sexual misbehavior on that campus, as there are on many campuses around the country. And part of the indictment that was issued in that story does not go away just because this story was false, and that's the real problem that a lot of victims and survivors are upset about, because now it's going to set back the issue of handling sexual assaults on campus a decade or two at least. Where people are going to now just look the other way or say the woman is probably lying or fabricating or embellishing, et cetera, which is not the case. UVA has a very bad track record of handling these things. They have never tossed anybody out of school for this. Their administrators have been very lax Their attitudes have been way too relaxed. I saw a woman administrator, a young woman administrator, actually say on TV that they discipline people within house, and if they agree to it, if they admit that they did something wrong, that's punishment enough kind of thing, and I just found that to be outrageous. So there's still a lot of problems that have to be dealt with at UVA and other campuses, but that doesn't allow for false accusations and a false story to be put out there, a false narrative, if you will. That's also just as egregious, right? I mean, you know, so we're setting things back. But the notion that she was trusting this woman and the woman's story when there were some red flags, the biggest of, you know, she had spoken to a lot of people on campus. This story, to her, was the most shocking and would have made the most compelling narrative. So she went with that. And I understand that as a writer, that you want to go with the most compelling thing. You want to open with something that's shocking, that's something that's going to grab people. If it's true. You know, if it's not true, then write a novel. I mean, I like writing. That's why I'm writing fiction, because I want to be able to embellish and make it larger than life. But you can't do that in journalism. And the point is, she had a red flag because this young woman, at one point, tried to withdraw the story. She didn't want it to be in there. She tried to get out of it, and they still ran with it. And when you start seeing someone say, I don't want to do it, I don't want to be included, that should be a red flag. Why don't you want to do it? Are you just embarrassed? And that might be alone. On a personal note, to say, if you care about this woman, as she claimed she did, to say, well, she really needs help and she doesn't want to get her story out there, and maybe we should just honor that, because we do have a backload of stories that we can fall back on and use. Why not? So that, to me, would be a red flag to just pull it. But she didn't pull it. And Rolling Stone didn't pull it, and they didn't vet anybody. And she had friends that they mentioned in the article, but they didn't give names to. These people have come forward to say that she kept changing her story, and there's probably something did happen to this young woman, it sounds like, at least from what the friends say, that she was traumatized in some way. She's not a complete fabulist. Who knows what it really was and why she decided to put it on these frat brothers, we don't really know. We'll never know, perhaps. Now, she's on the hot seat. Rolling Stone is kind of hedging. They're taking responsibility, but they're also kind of blaming her, which I think is outrageous, too. I mean, talk about journalistic ethics. You have to vet your stories. You have to be responsible for your stories. And putting it out there, frankly, has really eroded the trust in journalism, for sure. But more than importantly, I think it has set back the plight sexual assault victims and survivors a couple of good decades. So congratulations, Sabrina. You really did a great job, and congratulations, Rolling Stone, for not really taking as much responsibility as you should. Now, the fraternity that was involved apparently is preparing to sue Rolling Stone. I'm not sure if they're going to win the case. I don't know. They didn't mention anybody's name, so I don't know how that works, and if a fraternity can get their good name back, so to speak. Fraternities are under the gun for a variety of reasons at this point, some valid, some maybe not so valid. So it's interesting. What's your take? Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. We find out from the Washington Times that Terry McAuliffe has called the Rolling Stone rape story an abject failure of accountability in journalism. He's the governor of Virginia, and I would have to agree with that. Megyn Kelly on Fox News, in fact, I saw, and I don't usually watch Fox News, but I happen to stroll by late at night. I saw her do an interview with this young woman, Jackie's two friends, who actually seemed like very nice young guys, and they were pretty supportive of Jackie and thought something did happen to her, but they didn't think it was this because there were so many inconsistencies. They were also pretty generous when it came to Rolling Stone and the writer, where they didn't say they have to be fired, but maybe people will realize and think twice about it. And so, you know, I kind of applaud them. They came out as a very nice young man. Megyn Kelly says this was such a reckless disregard for the difference between truth and falsity. I think that's she's right. I mean, it really is. I mean, did they learn anything from this? Who knows? You know, it's crazy. What was the fun tweet? Do we have that one, Aurora, that somebody wrote that I thought was kind of intriguing because it was, I can't find it. Oh, yeah, here it is. Peter writes in, but hey, at least Rolling Stone fired a critic for dissing Hootie and the Blowfish in 1996. Don't mess with the Hootie. Indeed. Yeah, the standards are a little strange. I don't really quite get it. I just don't. I really don't, and I have to say it's a real disregard for accountability in journalism, and I think it sets us all back a lot. It also gets the idea of entrenched narrative. You want to believe a certain story. Remember, it goes back to the Ferguson story. You wanted to believe a certain story and a certain narrative about that young man and that police officer, and people got entrenched on both sides of it. And when things are occurring in real time, you have to be open to the fact that the narrative, if it's a real-life story, can change in real time as well. And I think that's where we fell short as a public reading it and consuming it, too. blotch, that's for sure. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes. Phone line 347-857-4505. Yeah, I think the Facebook page is open too, though, says Trudy. So.
I don't believe it.
Reach out.
Don't touch me. Hey, Ray. Hey, Sugar. Tell them who we are.
Well, we're big rock singers. We got golden fingers. And we're loved everywhere we go.
That sounds like us.
We sing about beauty and we sing about truth at $10,000 a show.
Right.
We take all kind of pills to give us all kind of thrills. But the thrill we've never known, it's the thrill that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
Yeah!
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
That's a very, very good idea.
I got a freaky old lady named a Cocaine Kitty who embroiders on my jeans. I got my poor old gray-haired daddy driving my limousine.
Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown. That's the blow that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see our pictures on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for our mother?
Yeah.
Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone?
Teenage blue-eyed groupies will do anything we say. We got a genuine Indian guru, he's teaching us a better way. We got all the friends that money can buy, so we never have to be alone. And we keep getting richer, but we can't get our picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
Wanna see my picture on the cover? Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother? Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone? On the cover of the Rolling Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover?
We ain't on the cover, baby.
Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother?
We would make a beautiful cover
of the Rolling Stone.
Right up front, man. I can see it now. We'd be on the front smiling, man. Oh, beautiful.
I want to see your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Dr. Hook, back when he was at the Medicine Show all those years ago on the Amy Beth Argui Show, as he talked about that scandalous Rolling Stone article. Dondi chiming in via Twitter. No surprises from the Columbia Review. We all knew that already. Still, horrible. Yeah, indeed. Well, it's true. They didn't really say anything. They just confirmed what we already knew and kind of put the professional patina on it that it was really an outrageous lapse in journalistic ethics, frankly. And I don't say that lightly, but it really was an unfortunate situation. And I can't believe a national publication of that stature would stoop to that and would not even correct it after the fact. Well, correct it. They took down the article. As we said, by taking down the article, they also took down all that important information and indictment on the University of Virginia's campus and the way they react to rape victims. It's just horrific. But you know what? I have to agree with the critics who say, you know, the false accusations, and there were false accusations in that infamous Duke LaCrosse case several years ago. I mean, you know, bad, being falsely accused is just as bad as being attacked. You know, you're picking on the wrong people, whether it's a completely fabricated story or you're just pushing the blame of something that did actually happen that was traumatic onto somebody else, it's just as egregious. So you can't stand by that, whatever your agenda may be, whatever your beliefs may be, because it's just not right. It's not fair to those guys. I agree with that. I also agree there is a very big problem on college campuses of date rapes, more date rapes than these gang rapes that this was asserted to be, frankly. But it is an issue, and it's nothing that you can just pretend doesn't exist because one person made up a story or it got distorted by a journalist who wanted to see this fabulous story, sensational story, I should say, on the pages of a national magazine. I remember years and years ago, I think it was in the 70s, I was a little kid, there was a story about Janet Cook, the reporter for the Washington Post, who won the Pulitzer Prize for a series of stories she did on a young, I don't even remember all the details, but a young heroin addict, I think, who was supposedly like under 12. And it came out that it was a fake story, that she kind of fabricated, and she did some research and she talked to some people, but she fabricated this particular kid and made up a lot of stuff. And again, that was first of the big fabulous stories, and she got canned. She got fired. The Pulitzer Prize was taken away, and I think she, you know, crawled into obscurity and did something else, as opposed to what happens now when people do these kinds of things, like Jason Blair and others. They make up stuff, and then they go on the Mea Culpa talk show tour. They write a book. They go on the talk show tour, and somehow their lives are restored. I don't know what actually Jason Blair, I think, is billing himself as a coach now. Personal coach. I got to get out of the business. Another crackpot. So I guess he did get out of the journalist business, but he had a book. And he went on the Mea Culpa talk show tour for a while. Or I don't know if he takes it to Mea Culpa. He kind of blamed the Times for his ills. But in any event, we give too many people. I think people have a right to have second chances. By all means, you can have redemption. You have to go away for a while, though. It seems like you want that instant redemption. You make a big blunder, you get caught, and then you cry on the Today Show tomorrow, like Paula Deen. And then there's a backlash to that, too, which isn't so great. So I don't know. It's a tough thing. But this story definitely will be... the ripples of this story in a very negative way are going to be felt for, unfortunately, I think, a long time. So congratulations, Rolling Stone. That's a big blotch on your resume. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 234-787-4505. It is the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. Speaking of people trying to redeem themselves, you know that viral video last week of the New York City detective who really lambasted that Uber driver who made a wrong turn or something or didn't signal, whatever the story was. I don't even know what the poor guy did, but he was very respectful to the detective, or so it seemed in the video that was taken by the passenger. But the guy just railed on him. He has been demoted. I guess he's off the terrorist task force, the detective, that is. And now he says, in an interview that he had on a local NBC affiliate in New York City, he wants to break bread with the guy. He'd like to take him to dinner to apologize. No word from the Uber driver if that's going to happen. But I have to say, the apology seemed a little on the reluctant side if you watched it. Look for it online because I'm sure you can find it. I don't have the audio on it. But he kind of said, yeah, he's sorry, but he had a bad day, and... you know, he kind of backpedaled around it, so I'm not so sure it was that great. But, you know, you think about these jobs, both the police, who have a very tough job, and it's a high-stress job, and cab drivers, who are often attacked, verbally, certainly, by customers, and sometimes physically their lives are in danger, and they're working real hard to make a living. So it's a tough thing, and sometimes the cab drivers and the cops don't get along too well either, and that's a tough thing, too. So we all have to decompress, take a deep breath, and honor those who do hard work in stressful jobs, and cut them a little slack, at least in our hearts, right? Especially when you're hailing a cab. Remember this one? Ooh, it's an old one from the Mills Brothers.
Cab driver, drive by Mary's place. I just want a chance to see her face. Don't stop the meter. There's a little place we used to eat. Do-do-be-do, do-do-be-do. That's where I laid my future at her feet. Do-do-be-do, do-do-be-do. Cab driver, once more down the street. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Cab driver, why don't you wait here by her door? Do-do-be-do, do-do-be-do. Perhaps I'll hold her in my arms once more. And then things will be just like they were before. Oh, cab driver, wait here by her door.
Hero. I was shot twice in the Tribune.
I read where you were shot 5 times in the tabloids.
It's not true. He didn't come anywhere near my tabloids.
Transfer's version of Trickle Trickle on the Amy Beth Arkley Show and the Mills Brothers and their old chestnut cab driver. How are you? Welcome aboard. It's a busy Tuesday. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright. Phone line, too, if you're listening live. Clank those tin cans in a string together for me, will you? 347-857-4505. Really fascinating show today. Thanks again going out to Lorraine Devon Wilkie. I really appreciate her insights and wisdom. All that artistic energy, which I think we all have to plug into as often as we can. Are you watching Mad Men? Speaking of artistic energy, as that landmark series is about to come to a close, 6 more episodes left, Don Draper is still in his existential downward spiral. Apparently it's April 1970. I didn't really know exactly what year it was or where we were at. The end of the last season, season 6, after the moon landing in July of 69, but reading some recaps, I found that out after the fact. They claim you could tell by the mustaches and the clothes, but yeah, Roger and Ted were sporting some odd-looking mustaches, that's for sure. Distracting, in fact. But interesting, Don Draper starting where you know, where he always left off. He wears the same conservative early 1960s suits. He doesn't really change his style. And nor does he change his habits, I guess. They open with him auditioning models for a fur coat campaign, kind of where he started with his first wife, Betty, who was apparently a model, and he met her in that arena, although we don't see that on camera, I suppose. But January Jones, by the way, who plays Betty, not seen in the other night's first episode of the final season, and you got to see more Betty and Sally to really appreciate the story. But she says she doesn't think Matthew Weiner, the creator, is going to wrap things up neatly. Well, she should know because she went through the series already, but they're always sworn to secrecy. They can't reveal what happens. We'll see what happens. I think they opened and closed the episode with a playing in the background of Peggy Lee's Anthem to Ennui, Is That All There Is, which inexplicably I think was the Grammy-winning song of 1969. It's a talky little song, but it kind of wraps things up, I think, some things up for the characters and for the audience. I'm always a little underwhelmed at the first episode of every season, it seems. Maybe I just have to get back in the swing of things. But a lot did happen, a lot of ground covered. I don't want to talk too much about it for spoiler alerts. If anybody hasn't seen it, go watch it. But there's some fascinating things. And Joan and Peggy, of course, off the chain as usual in a major way. We'll see. I think they should have like a spinoff with Joan and Peggy doing like a Thelma and Louise, not Thelma and Louise, but sort of like a tag team career girls of the 1970s spinoff, but I don't think that's going to happen with Elizabeth Moss and Christina Hendricks. They just do a great job, but it's a great show, and I'm in it all the way. How about you? Any thoughts on Mad Men without revealing a lot too much, because I know some people haven't watched the episode yet. A.B. Wright is the Twitter handle. 347-857-4505. If you're listening live, for goodness sakes, reach out those tin cans and a string. Will you please? Some people don't like to call in. I don't know. I know we have many more listeners on podcasts, but we do have some people listening live, and they seem to prefer Twitter over the phone lines. I'm not sure why, but that's okay. You know, I'm an old-school radio person who was used to, you know, talking with, arguing with, and kibitzing with listeners live on the air. So, but now we're doing our internet podcast thing, and it's a different kind of deal. It's also a different kind of deal with the studio setup, so they're always possible frustrations. I have to say things are going better than I thought they would after yesterday's little tryout on the new system with the audio files. Things seem to be okay, so I'm happy about that. Thank you so much for that. Hey, speaking of shows coming up on Friday, don't forget one of our fan faves, Dr. Daniela Schreier, is back to talk about some of the real-time stories in the justice arena from Jodi Arias getting sentenced next week, finally, to Robert Durst, all that craziness, the infamous James Arthur Ray and his latest efforts to capitalize on his tragedy and prison sentence. All of that, maybe Amanda Knox as well. George Zimmerman, what's on your mind? If you have a case, a topic you'd like Dr. Daniela to handle, reach out via Twitter at AB Writes, hashtag Justice Junkies or Justice, or you can do so via the website abbetharkawi.com, and we will talk about it as time permits on Friday. That's always a hot show. The justice stories always generate a lot of interest, that's for sure. And if you miss any of the shows, don't forget you can follow the AB Beth Arkawi Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. You can download episodes there, iTunes, NetNow, and of course the website, abbetharkawi.com. Got those rainy day songs on my mind. Here comes one from the Fortunes.
Here comes that rainy day feeling again. And soon my tears, they will be falling like rain.
insanity runs in my family.
It practically gallops.
From Kentucky. He's not calling himself Senator Paul, but rather Dr. Paul officially launches his bid for the GOP nomination today. His campaign slogan, tagline, I think, is something like, defeat the Washington machine, unleash the American dream. It sounds 1975, doesn't it? We'll see how that goes. Marco Rubio expected later this week, and the Big H, Hillary Clinton, for the Democratic nomination. She's got to announce pretty soon because apparently she just leased campaign space in Brooklyn last week, and there's some rule that says if you've leased space for a political campaign, you have to announce within 15 days. So I guess this week or early next week, look for that announcement to be officially made and start the Clinton fan.
That's the last straw.
Uh-oh, are we getting ready to get out of here?
If that's not enough to get you out of bed, something's seriously wrong.
Wow, that was like a miracle.
It's one of those performances that I will never, ever forget.
We want you to have a great damn day.
That inspired me to be a better person.
Well, I hope you do have a great damn day on the Amy Beth Erkwi Show. Thanks again going to Lorraine Devon Wilkie. What an intriguing multi-talented artist she is. Find out more about her music and her books at LorraineDevonWilkie.com. Hysterical.com. And good luck with the new book, Hysterical Love. Hey, thanks for joining us, too. Appreciate the comments on the Twitter feed. And, well, we didn't get any calls today, did we? So forget it. Hey, follow the Amy Beth Darkwee Show at the Twitter feed at AB Writes. Trudy, our producer at Radio Trudy. You can friend me on Facebook. And you can, of course, follow it all at the Blog Talk Radio site and the website, AmyBethArkwee.com, where you can chime in if you want to be a guest on the show, have any suggestions or comments, creativity coaching questions, and of course peruse my stories, the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, both Killing Time and Dead Silent, available for ebook and paperback. And yeah, we're working on number three, indeed. Hey, also, what happened yesterday? Opening day of baseball. Mets are in first place officially. I love it. They beat the Nationals 3-1. So let's go for a big fat season. Thank you to the TCS crew, Trudy, Aurora in the booth, ML at TCS headquarters. Whatever you do, wherever you go, please drive safe, play nice, dream big, and come on back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkwee Show. Put me in, coach. I'm ready to play. Leave you with John Fogerty in center field. Take care.
Good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Just